Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander listeners are warned that the following podcast program may contain stories, names and voices of deceased persons.
This is Outback Out Loud.
People and stories from Outback New South Wales.
You get the first ray of light and the last ray of light.
Peace and quiet, worth its weight in gold.
We're coming to you from Galaganban.
The whole of Nevertire are our neighbours.
Check out Corinda.
Welcome to Growin', to the club in the scrub.
I've lived in Gadigal all my life.
We drove into Lightning Ridge and I was coming home.
Outback Out Loud!
That's what I like.
Welcome to Outback Out Loud, Season 3, Villages.
In this season, we explore stories and life experiences from the most remote centres in New South Wales.
This is Galaganbone, Episode 2. Up next, we catch up with Annette Fisher, who makes coffee at the 2828 Cafe.
We're at 2828, which is a cafe, and before that it was a hall, so it was built in 1922 for the soldiers returning from the First World War. They built it three times. I think one got burnt down, the next one blew away, and so they made something that is still here today. And then there was a small group of us that decided to buy this building, which was owned by a man called Peter Simpson, who was a local. And he had it as his pump shop. So he had it on the market for $40,000 and he gave it to us for $5,000. So the council put in half of it and we had a dinner under the stars to raise the funds for the rest of it. So that was 2002. There was a dwelling on the stage area. And so that all had to be removed. We basically got it back to how it originally was. We cleaned up the floors, but we left spots where the oil from the motorbikes or the whatever that he was working on is still patches of it around, so that we can remember the fact that he gave it to us very cheaply and we were very thankful. We had working bees constantly. Everyone volunteered. There were lots of things that had to be removed and scraped back and repainted, and the inside and the out. And then in our wisdom, we decided we'd have this cafe, and which we were going to just have coffee and scones. That was what it was all about. It didn't take long for all the local ladies that came to volunteer started cooking lunches and all sorts of things. But it was run with volunteers from the beginning, in when it opened in 2004 to 2016. In 17, we leased it out, which we have done ever since, because volunteers either died or left the district. Well, we've had four different people to lease it. The first one was really good and she only wanted it for a year, and the next were two fellows that came from Gilgandra and they nearly got 12 months and then they decided enough was enough and they left. And so in the meantime, we've come back as volunteers and run it in between till we got someone else. The next girl was a disaster and we had to ask her to leave. Nicole, who's back here at the moment, she leased it for 5 years, which has been great. But she now has grandchildren and would like to spend more time. We're all back volunteering again. And look, it's a lovely place to work, and everybody wants it to be here because there's nowhere else to get a coffee or a sandwich or anything. We use Victoria Coffee because one of the ladies that was heavily involved, her brother in Sydney was at a dinner sitting next to Les Shirato, who owns Victoria Coffee. He's probably retired now and maybe his son's running it. Not quite sure, but they gave us coffee from the beginning and the coffee machine and cups, everything that went with it. That was a gift to us from him because he thought it was such a great idea. And, so over the time, even up until we leased it, the coffee was supplied by Victoria Coffee, which was amazing, a great thing for a company in Sydney to do. So we still use all their coffee, and because we appreciate it. We're on our third coffee machine, courtesy of Vittoria Coffee, which is wonderful. So then, Dinner Under the Stars, they were very supportive in that as well. So we decided to have Dinner Under the Stars because we needed to upkeep the building. So, and that worked really well in our back outside space, and possibly went from maybe 200 people to eventually up to 450 people over different years. So we used to do it every year. We sort of hadn't had one since 2017. So then last year, I want to say, or it might have been the year before, we decided to go ahead and start it up again. So it sometimes rains, so then we had to move it to the hall across the road, because we can really add a squeeze. We can put 125 people in here with tables and chairs and what have you, but that's very, for any more, it'd be very squishy. So, but we've got a beautiful area and down the back, and we've just literally sat under the stars and had dinner. Well, it's a three-course meal, so she usually does the entree and the main course, and it's alternate drop normally, so that if you don't like what you've got, you can swap with your neighbour. And then the last few years we've done the dessert ourselves, because we've got very capable women here to cook. Our idea was just to do small desserts, and people could come and go and have as many as they like, and that seems to work well. If you're driving through Galar, stop and drive down the main street, and not only will you see some lovely artwork, the cafe's here. We do nice cakes and you know, then lovely sandwiches and things like, yeah, all those sorts of things. You can't go past a scone, actually. I think everybody likes a scone. So generally it opens Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, yeah.
The first post office was in Scunthorpe's Hotel in 1871. It was a place where wagons, the Cobb and Co mail, and travellers refreshed or stopped on their journeys from Canamble to Bourke.
Hey, I'm Tammy. We're in the main street of Galagambone. So I run the post office, the RTC, which is a community-owned post office. So I'm the manager down there. And we also do the library as a volunteer 4 days a week for the Canamble Shire. Yep, it's run by volunteers. They closed our post office, they closed our bank. So then the community got together, they bought the building. So the community owned the building. And then they got a one-off grant to get it all set up, and now we're a transaction-based business. So the way we survive is transactions made over the counter. So whenever anyone pays a bill, we get a commission for that. Whenever anyone does a withdrawal or a deposit, we get a commission for that. And the funds just go back into the community. So we don't get anything from the government. We just survive solely on over-the-counter transactions, and plus the giftware that I do on the side. It's good. Online has hurt us in a big way. Like, all the younger generation pay all their accounts online, they do all their transactions online. It's just the elderly that sort of still do pay all their accounts over the counter. But it's the giftware, and we're a Centrelink agent as well, so we get commission off Centrelink that keeps us going. And this library, we get paid by the Shire to run this as well. I was actually born in Coleraine-Bray. I don't know where we come from then, but I went to school here from kindergarten. Went straight through school to year 10, finished year 10, had a job the next day. I first had my first job at the cafe, the local cafe here. I think I was on $3.50 an hour. I used to work from like 8 o'clock to 11 o'clock at night. I've done rouseabouting for years in the sheds, in the shearing sheds. Love that, absolutely love that. Then I worked at the supermarket for years over there, probably 20 odd years over there. And then I went from there to the RTC, and I've been there for 22, 23 years. You walk down the street, hey Tammy, hey, like, you drive past, you're waving to everybody, like, everybody knows everybody. That's a good community. Yeah. My kids can come down the street, people still say hi, you know, they know who they are. Yeah, it's good. My parents lived here, my nan lived here, I've got aunties and uncles here, like, a few of them have passed, but I just love Galagambone.
G'day everyone, my name's James Best and we're coming to you from Galagambone. I grew up on our family farm, about 12k out of town, and yeah, a lot of memories, especially as a younger kid, was driving around the place with my late grandfather, checking the stock and that sort of thing. There was a hell of a lot of sport for a small town like Galar. Junior soccer, junior cricket, little athletics, swimming, time trials. We had junior golf for a bit. I avoid horses, but there was a pony club as well that a lot of kids got into. Yeah, a lot really did happen. And yeah, another thing I can remember as a kid too, yeah, Galagamone used to have goat races, so that used to intrigue me quite a lot. If I could probably sum it up in one word, pandemonium. yeah, so it was just based at the local showground and racecourse on the racetrack. Yeah, I was very young when it started, but most people, their goats did the job. For some people, they probably didn't quite make the end of the course, but it was more just a chance to see your mates. I guess they would have released them out of the barrier, like the horses, and yeah, you had people in a cart just hanging on for dear life, I think. I don't know how they pulled the goats up, but most people would come back. Australia's an island, so if they didn't come back at the end of the track, they would have pulled up somewhere. Our family's a very small family. A lot of my father was an only child, my grandfather was an only child. It was pretty sad, actually, when I got told you won't be staying here, you'll be going away to school next year. But I guess the beauty of where I went, it was an agricultural high school and it was only 3 hours away. So, yeah, I adjusted pretty quickly. And I'm not shy at meeting people, so I made new friends pretty quickly. And I think the reason why my parents enrolled me there was probably more from the agricultural end, just to give me a lead in to pursue potentially like an agricultural career. And then I spent a bit of time working up there with a cotton agronomist. And yeah, it was only because we took on a bit more share farming that I came back. Otherwise, I probably would have been pretty keen to stay up there and get a job as an agronomist and yeah, just spend a bit of time away before coming back. We're a mixed farm, so we run cattle, sheep and winter cropping. Some days you could be in the yards sort of handling livestock. Other days you could be like, you're a part-time mechanic sometimes fixing machinery. You're a part-time boilermaker sometimes welding. You're a part-time vet sometimes when you have a sick animal. You're a part-time agronomist when you really need to check a crop and agronomist or consultant can't come out and have a look at it. So, yeah, I guess to answer your question in that sense, it does take a lot of, yeah, it takes attention to detail, but it does take more than just knowing a tiny bit about agriculture. Yeah, you do need other life skills to go with it. Yeah, timing with a lot of things is paramount. The better you are with your timing, the better off you'll be, like particularly planting crops, animal welfare too, like with sheep, for example. Timing's really, really it more than anything, yeah. I found a mentor for life with some work experience I did, and that mentor's always happy to stop and give me some time. And locally in town, there are a couple of people that, you might run into them at a local do or down the street or in the pub, and you start picking their brains, and they're always more than happy to share their expertise and reflect on some of their past experiences. Pretty fortunate we have people like that that are so open with what they've done right and, more importantly, what they've done wrong. Yeah, I guess there's always some sort of curveball. Yeah, if it's not a drought, it rains, and then, like, you get a mouse plague. It's not a mouse plague, it's something external, like, say, government policy. Yeah, it could be anything. I think you've always got to be on your toes, but I think a lot of producers too, they've been there and seen it, and I've seen a lot of stuff even in my 10 or 12 years at home. So, yeah, you just brace yourself for anything and make sure you have a good business model to allow for those changes. We had a lot of rain in 2020. It was a drought-breaking year. And because our hay supplies had taken quite a hit, our main objective was to build those reservoirs back up. And, yeah, just as we went on with that job, collecting the hay, we just noticed the hay was getting harder and harder to pick up. And, yeah, we found out there was more and more mice running around the paddock. And we were getting rain sort of probably every week. So there was a few days there where you physically couldn't get on the paddock to pick up your hay to bring it into the yard. And you know, I noticed every week after that rain, that mouse population got bigger and bigger. And the last 100 bales, you physically couldn't pick up with the tractor and, yeah, and load. The mice had just got into them that much. I remember going to a local wedding west of town. They had it in a wool shed, and I just remember all these mice sort of running around there. They didn't obviously eat the wedding cake or anything like that. They weren't that bad, but you know, you talk to a person and you just see a few mice scurrying along everywhere. Yeah, there was a lot of furniture being thrown out for sure. A lot of machinery. People probably don't think about this, but you know, the mice chewing important wires and cables. Yeah, so the auto electricians, they probably had a good year that year fixing up a lot of these chewed wires, for example. Yeah, I can remember just two of our older trucks. God, just the smell. Look, and just the amount of times I had to scrub them and wipe them out just to make it feel like you're actually driving the truck again and you're not living in a mouse nest. It's not always McLeod's daughters, put it that way. The worst thing is it's been a couple of years since the mice have been here, so they're probably going to be due back sooner rather than later. So some days when things go wrong, you think, what am I doing? But 99.9% of the time, no. Rain, hail, shine, drought, flood, no, it's what I want to do.
There were big floods in 1920 and the 1950s, fires in 1931, and occasional droughts that resulted in stock losses and challenges to the townspeople, local farmers and graziers. In the 1950s and 60s, Galagambone thrived. Every Saturday morning, the local farmers came to town to socialise, play sport, do their banking, mail and buy supplies. The town won Tidy Town Awards in 1985, and town facilities were revitalised for community events. Town buildings are significant examples of late 19th and early 20th century country town architecture. Present-day Galar celebrates these buildings with colourful frontages and public art.
My name's Colin Ryan, born in Gilgandra. When my mother brought me back to Galagambone, that's where I've been ever since. I went to school here. We'd get home from school at roughly 4 o'clock, and most times there was a cereal on at 4 o'clock, so you'd have to rush to get home off the bus. It was something that you'd listen to. This went for about 5 or 10 minutes or something like that. Yeah, this was just a story about like a bush ranger, or it could have been, I can't really remember what it was about, but something like that. Just getting home, just continue on the next episode of this cereal. It's a very important thing. The battery got flat on the radio. It was big chaos. Everyone, you go back to school and talk to one another the next day about what happened on the radio. Our first mode of transport when we were kids was a horse and sulky. So I can remember coming into town. We lived about 2 or 3 k's out of town on the Gilgandra side. Coming to town on Saturday morning was a big thing. Our dad would bring us in the horse and sulky, and we'd tie it up on the hotel block there. Mum would do the shopping and stuff, and then we might get a treat or two, I'd say. It was a really big deal when Dad had his first vehicle, like a little truck. Yeah, it was a big thing. The way things were then, you know, it was a big transition between horse-drawn and mechanical, yeah.
Thanks for listening. To hear more amazing stories from Outback New South Wales, check out the whole Outback Out Loud series, now streaming everywhere.
We acknowledge and celebrate the first Australians on whose traditional lands we meet and work, and whose cultures are among the oldest continuing cultures in human history.
Please like, subscribe, rate us and write a review. The Outback Out Loud podcast was designed and produced by Signal Creative and is a collaboration between Signal Creative and Outback Arts. The Outback Out Loud community project and workshop series was designed and facilitated by Signal Creative. These episodes are the result of recordings and interviews collected by Signal Creative and community participants. You can find Signal Creative at signalcreative.net and Outback Arts at outbackarts.com.au, and you can find both of us on Facebook and Instagram. Audio production, sound and music design by Emma Hoy. Community liaison, research and editing by Caroline Wallace.